From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, comic and actress Marga Gomez pays tribute to her show business father, a Cuban-born comic, MC, and theater owner in the days when Latino vaudeville flourished in New York. His story is the subject of Marga Gomez's new performance piece, A Line Around the Block. Her previous piece paid tribute to her mother, who was an exotic dancer. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the latest recording by mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt. It's Handel's Ariodante. Then we meet Lorraine Hunt, who's been described as the reigning Handel diva of our day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. After the bond market's nosedive Friday, the stock market has followed suit today, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunging over 125 points in reaction to last week's stronger-than-expected report on March employment. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Within minutes of today's opening, the Dow was down more than 60 points. It then continued to fall. The sharp drop had been widely expected. On Friday, the Labor Department reported that businesses added 140,000 jobs to their payrolls in March, more than economists had been expecting. The report sparked fears among investors that inflation might be on the rise, and that in turn led to concern that the Federal Reserve could begin raising interest rates. There was an immediate drop in bond prices, but because of the Friday holiday, the stock market couldn't respond to the news until today. The big drop in stock and bond prices is a repeat of what happened last month after a much stronger than expected jobs report. In that case, stock prices eventually regained much of what they lost, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average went on to set a record. This is Jim Zaroli in New York.
Convicted child molester Larry McQuay has been released from prison in Texas, and he's being taken to a halfway house in San Antonio. McQuay calls himself a child molesting demon, and his warnings that he would harm more children drew protests that temporarily stalled his release. But prison officials say state law requires that he be freed now that he has served 6 years for an attack on a little boy. McQuay wants the state to castrate him at public expense. Authorities say he will remain under close supervision at the halfway house. Tens of thousands of people are fleeing the growing violence in Liberia. The recent fighting erupted this weekend in Monrovia between government troops and forces loyal to a deposed warlord. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Thousands are stranded, their homes burned and looted. A U.S. embassy spokesman says 10 to 15,000 people have taken refuge there. Yet even that usually safe neighborhood was threatened after West African peacekeepers abandoned their posts and rebels ransacked a nearby United Nations office. The melee began Saturday as government forces clashed with supporters of a militia leader wanted on murder charges. Other militia groups joined each side, and the fighting soon resembled the factional free-for-all that has killed 150,000 Liberians and displaced half the population. By now, Liberia's guerrillas were to have been disarmed. That process stalled after a December ambush on peacekeepers. Elections, once scheduled for August, appear increasingly unlikely. I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 132.5 points at 5,550 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite is down over 23 points. This is NPR News. In New York today, the United Nations and Iraq are to hold new talks on a proposal that would allow Iraq to sell limited amounts of oil in order to buy food for its increasingly hungry population. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The talks resume against a stark backdrop. A recent World Health Organization report estimates that 5 years of sanctions has set back overall health care in Iraq by half a century. Until now, Iraq has refused to take advantage of a proposal that allows it to sell up to $2 billion of oil every 6 months to buy food and medicine. This time it looked as if Iraq might finally agree. Officials added that a previous round of talks last month had shown progress. However, a key outstanding issue is Baghdad's refusal to allow the UN to bypass its authority and distribute food directly in the northern Kurdish region. Last week, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz suggested this latest round of talks is unlikely to succeed, adding that an additional fourth round may be necessary. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says despite the recent incursions by North Korean troops into the demilitarized zone, the administration hasn't seen anything that indicates an offensive buildup that implies hostilities. Jim Cole, a spokesman for the UN command, says the situation is serious but not alarming.
What we have here are a series of very serious violations of the 1953 armistice, but what we're not seeing is anything that indicates that we need to view this situation with any particular alarm. We are seeing absolutely no troop movements in the north, anywhere except for this illegal training they're doing inside the truce village, their portion of the truce village of Panmunjom.
So far, the UN has not changed its troop deployment in the region. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Marga Gomez is a performer who has played lots of different circuits, the comedy clubs, feminist theater, Latino theater, and gay festivals. She's also written a series of three autobiographical performance pieces, one about herself, called Marga Gomez is Pretty, Witty, and Gay, one about her mother, who was an exotic dancer who grew up in Puerto Rico, and a new one, which is a tribute to her father. He was a Cuban-born comic, MC, and theater owner in New York's Spanish showbiz in the 50s through 70s. His stage name, Willie Chevalier, was inspired by French star Marie Chevalier. Marga Gomez's show is called A Line Around the Block, and she's performing it at the Joseph Papp Public Theater in Manhattan through April 21st. A New York Times review described her as a splendid mimic, keen-eyed sociologist, and captivating storyteller. Her father was quite a storyteller himself. In her show, she tells some of the stories he used to tell her, stories that usually stretched the truth.
Marga, you know how much your steak weighs? 2 pounds. Have you ever tasted anything like that? It's army style. You remember, I was a cook in the army. Oh, you don't believe me? Tomorrow, I'm going to find my medal and show you. Did I ever tell you how I got my medal? Well, I was cooking some chicken for the troops, and I hear something behind me. I pretend I don't notice, and I continue with the chicken. But I always carry a little mirror in the pocket of my uniform. I take it out, and in the trees behind me, I could see the Nazi. But he don't know that I see him. He thinks, oh, that guy, he's just cooking chicken. Now I play a game with him. With one hand, I cook the chicken. With the other hand, I watch the Nazi. I cook the chicken. I watch the Nazi. I season the chicken. A little salt, oregano, limon. I can't tell you too much. It's a secret. I watch the Nazi. Chicken, Nazi, chicken, Nazi, chicken, Nazi. Like that. Then, with my other hand, I take the rifle, shoot behind me. Bam! Got him. Turn the chicken.
Would you describe for us the part of Spanish show business that he was a part of?
Well, I think it was a lot like vaudeville shows, and maybe like what killed vaudeville. He did all kinds of acts. He was a real live entertainer. He was supposedly a dancer in the 50s, and he had this act where he would do at the end, the finale. He'd do a backflip and catch his partner's handkerchief with his teeth and land on his feet. But he went to New York from Havana and became an MC and also an impresario. So he would host variety shows with orchestras and singers like Celia Cruz, of course, the most famous one I think we know of, La Lupe, and then odd kinds of novelty acts, contortionists, a lot like the old Ed Sullivan show where you have the people spinning the plates, but in my dad's show the plates would fall, and then he would have little sketches that he would write like La Familia Cómica, and if he had had, let's say, a Mexican movie star appearing in his show that week, then that movie star would be a player in the sketch or a singer, you know, anybody that could act. He'd throw him into the sketch. He had like a series of about 20, 30 sketches and then horror sketches, too.
Well, actually, you do one of those horror sketches in your show.
Yes, the 13 Minutos. My dad, it would start out in a cemetery set, and my father would be the host, and he'd say, Soy Caballero 13, that's Mr. 13. Soy Caballero 13, and I will tell you in 13 minutos terrible events that took place 13 years ago. The one I'll tell you tonight takes place in the garden of Leonardo, a horticultural scientist who spent his life trying to grow an especial orchid that was the color black, 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 like a funeral.
Did you ever have a part in 13 Minutos?
No, I never did have a part in that, but I did get some work from my father. One was throwing coffee into the audience, and that I only got to do once because I got so excited, being live on stage, that I threw the coffee too hard and I hit one woman in the head and messed up her hair, and she complained.
And why were you throwing coffee into the audience?
Oh, why? Because it was a giveaway. It was a Café El Pico giveaway, mm-hmm. And it's sort of when people would like win dishes or something when they to get people into the theater, not just a show, but they would also have to be merchandise that you get also to go to the theater. And besides that, a Mexican movie. After the live show, you would get to see one of our wonderful movies that sort of aped Hollywood, and they were fabulous. I mean, I couldn't even speak Spanish, but I always knew what was happening in these movies because they were so emotional. Te quiero, te odio, ay, ya no puedo tener niños, déjame, déjame. And those were the comedies.
So if you didn't speak Spanish, then how do you do it now?
How do I do what?
Did you learn Spanish as an adult?
No. It's a source of embarrassment, shame, toxic shame, toxico shamo. I don't know how to say it. But I didn't. See, when I was young, I was raised by a pack of wild Irish nuns, and they called it Catholic school. And they really encouraged us to adopt the ways of the popular culture, the dominant culture, and so I lost my Spanish. Spanish was the first language that I learned, and then somehow I lost it. And now I'm at the point where I know a lot of Spanish words, a lot of vocabulary, but I don't have the grammar. But eventually, on my list of things I want to accomplish in my life is a complete command of the Spanish language.
When your father had his own theater and he used to introduce the acts,
yes.
Did he have a great way of doing that? Could you do him being an MC?
Well, I can't. I can't remember. It was just it was incredible superlatives. It didn't matter if this was a lady he had met at the corner bodega, but everybody was usually directamente de España or de Peru or someplace. They just they couldn't possibly be from 169th Street. Yesterday, they came, they flew into this show, and and then they would be, the greatest, and they'd have, la dinámica, la vedette, la, explosiva. Everybody was explosive. The women were all explosive, and so when they were all número uno, everybody was number one, that week. Then they would have a different number one singer.
Did you feel like you learned the art of hyperbole when you were growing up?
Well, yes, but then, then I did go to Catholic school, so I have, I'm sort of skitsy about that, from being, these delusions of grandeur to this, humble martyr mode that I get into also. But I could, I could do it, and I certainly, I'm drawn to being like a publicist. I used to do my own publicity and all that, but yes, I know that bigger is better, and that whenever anybody asks me where I've been, I say España, directamente de España. Yes, I've been in Europe.
One of the things that really interests me about your show, based on your father, is that it brings to life a whole part of Spanish show business from the 50s and 60s that I'm really not familiar with. And it's just really interesting. Is that part of what you wanted to do?
Well, yeah, I think that people are familiar with the musical artists from that time, but you know, there was you know, they were in this context of these teatros, and these teatros were also a place where everybody went. And these were, you know, people coming, you know, from Cuba and Puerto Rico and then the Dominican Republic into New York. And these were people, they were homesick, you know, and this was this was a meeting place for everybody in the community. So it was, you know, it was an event. It wasn't, you know, just all about the show. It was about everybody just trying to carry on and get a little strength from, you know, from the show that weekend and from reconnecting with their neighbors.
My guest is Marga Gomez. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Marga Gomez. Her new performance piece is a tribute to her father, who performed in New York's Latino show business in the 50s through 70s. You know what I'm wondering? What sense you got of adult life? Growing up with your parents, one of whom was an exotic dancer, and the other, you know, was part impresario, part comic, part MC. And then there were all these kind of, you know, interesting characters who you'd meet backstage. I mean, the people you were exposed to in the adult world were all probably very eccentric.
Well, everybody wore pancake, you know, Maron pancake makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody did. My dad did, you know. And I, you know, actually never got into makeup too much sort of now at this stage of life. But so I was definitely, you know, used to flamboyance and people dressed up, lots of cologne, lots of hairspray, and you know, my mom used some too. You know, people loud, you know, I mean, I'd be going, you know, I'd have to go to school and they're, you know, they would be carrying on and screaming and blending, you know, drinks and partying until, you know, four, five, six later in the morning, people be, you know, I'd be going to school and there'd be, you know, a magician asleep on the sofa. but it was, you know, it was cool. I mean, I was actually able to, you know, to do pretty good when in school when my parents were together. Although I would go, you know, I was going to Catholic school and the nuns, you know, really looked down, you know, on the fact that my parents were in show business and hadn't been married in a church. But I really, I'm very, you know, I've always been very comfortable with that life, and I think it really made it hard for me to think about doing anything else, you know, any kind of regular job.
You must have been so confused going from the world of, you know, this flamboyant Spanish show business to the world of the nuns in Catholic school.
Yeah, yeah. And then as far as sexuality, you know, we had a lot of female impersonator friends, too. That was, you know, that was always very big. That will never die. And so they were always over, too. So that all, you know, so I had a pretty good education right from the get-go.
Here's what I'm wondering. If you ended up in an even greater culture clash than you were in when you were a child and going to Catholic school while, you know, your parents were throwing wild parties after the shows in their house, when you started to perform, maybe now as well, you were playing a lot of gay clubs, mm-hmm. and gay, you know, performance events. And I think, you know, again, it's a question of, you know, what does it mean to be a woman? What images do you have? And you grew up with these images of these, you know, like sexy bombshell performers and your mother an exotic dancer and your father's the real, like, macho, you know, macho guy. And, you know, then you're off performing in the lesbian feminist world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but also, you know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of femininity there. You know, I did a lot of drag shows, too, so, you know.
Really?
It's, yeah, yeah, you know. I mean, there's a range of style right now in the, you know, in dyke fashion. So, you know, there are actually some babes who look just like my mom. but I think, what was the question? Sorry, I was thinking about the babes who look like my mom.
About culture clash.
Actually, you know, the performance scene that I went to, I moved to San Francisco and I started playing in the clubs there, you know, really felt like my parents, you know, because everybody was so free and everybody was creating their own legend and their own, you know, it was, I guess, you know, an alternative culture, just as my parents' world was an alternative culture. I think the biggest culture clash was when I was, when my parents split up and I lived in Long Island. That was, because there was no fancy, there's no festiveness there, you know. Everything was very, suburban.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was something about, yeah, it was about city life and nightlife. And so,
being larger than life.
Exactly. So, we tend to do that in San Francisco, where I live. And,
Now, when you started performing as a comic, did you include material about your parents?
A little bit. I think I would start to. I think one of the first jokes I did was about my mom. I'd say when I was. Because I was starting comedy in the early 80s in San Francisco, and I started playing a club called the Valencia Rose that had gay and lesbian comedy. So they really encourage you to do out material. And one of my first jokes was my mom was very protective because I was growing up in New York. So every time I left the house, she'd tell me the same thing. Marguita, when you go out alone or you're by yourself, I don't care if you're in church or the movies, always sit next to a lady. Don't forget, sit next to a lady. And then she wondered why I never married. But it was true. My mom always, you know, she was, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know what happened to her when she was a kid. Probably, you know, not a good thing. And so she was always worried that, you know, I would get molested. And, and yet she never really realized that I would just continue with these instructions into my adult life.
When you were young, did your father give you lessons in how to put a joke across?
No. My father really thought that I was going to go and be a doctor. In fact, for the longest time, even as he was in his later years and working in this little dive on 7th Avenue here in New York, he was telling his friends that I was in medical school in Spain, and because Spain is always superior to Cuba or Puerto Rico. And I was already performing, you know. I was already, you know, going out to the clubs and in some theater troupes and acting. And he, you know, he always said that was a wonderful thing. And he'd write me letters and say, it's in your blood. Don't forget you have the Gomez Estremera. That's my mother's maiden name, blood. And yet, you know, he just loved to spin a tale.
Your father seems like, such an eccentric, colorful character. And yet I can imagine that there were times it was very trying to have him as your father, because he always seemed to have a scheme that couldn't possibly work. And his stories to you seem to be spiced with a lot of lies and certainly a lot of embroidery. And that, I don't know, was that confusing to you as a child?
No, not as a child. You know, I really, he made me feel wonderful about myself. Of course, when he was really successful, I didn't see too much of him. So he was just this, you know, figure that, you know, was there when I came home from school in his pajamas having his first cup of coffee, you know, before he went to the show. And he was, a hero. He was a hero. And, as I got into those critical teenage years, his fortunes began to dwindle. And also, you know, he began to drink. And that's where the tough part came, because, I was afraid of to see my father fail. I think, a lot of kids probably have that. Now, in retrospect, and in writing this show, I'm I'm very proud of him, and I want the show to come off as a tribute. I have, again, when he died, I cleaned out his apartment, so I have some letters and that he wrote to me, he was like 2 years away from dying, and he was still thinking that things would change, that if he went, let's say, to Puerto Rico, where there was still a lot of, connections with Latino entertainment, that he would get a break. You know, this was before he got diagnosed with throat cancer. It was just amazing that he never gave up. And I think that's something to be proud of, to be so optimistic when everything is so difficult, when your method of working is basically gone, and yet, believing that you can overcome that is something that, that I still need to learn from him, and that I think would be helpful.
You know, when people lose their parents or when a parent becomes terminally ill, people are left with their memories and their photographs. You've kind of made yourself into your parents. You've incorporated them into yourself and perform them.
I know. It's weird. Personally, my life is that's been my life, really. I was in a relationship for several years, and it was a good relationship, and yet I just was driven to do this. I just really think that because it meant so much to them, and maybe because in their marriage I was the only child, that, I witnessed it, and I witnessed it, not coming to fruition. I just wanted to have it done. And, if the shows get... hopefully into some other form, a book or a movie or whatever, I'll be happy, because a live show, especially solo, I suppose other people could perform it, but I just wanted to live on. I really want that to be their legacy. And then I really am at the point now that I feel closure with it, so I can actually get into other things.
Like what? What would you like to do?
I could actually do some dumb stuff now. Horror movies, romantic comedies. I mean, I guess I'd like to write. I'm a slow writer, and I don't find being, locked up in the, at my desk for days and days and months to be fun. But maybe if it wasn't quite so important and critical, I could write a little faster, and it would be cool to try my hand at that and acting. I mean, all kinds of things.
Okay. Marga Gomez, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a personal highlight for me.
Marga Gomez is performing her show, A Line Around the Block, at the Joseph Papp Public Theater in Manhattan through April 21st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harper San Francisco, publisher of the illustrated World's Religions by religion historian Houston Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, gender-bending opera style, we meet mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt. She often sings roles that were written for men, castrati. She's been described as the reigning Handel diva of our day and has appeared in Peter Sellers' productions of operas by Handel and Mozart. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Hunt's latest Handel recording. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lorraine Hunt was a successful violist when she decided to become a singer. It struck many people as improbable that someone pushing 30 could successfully make the transition and launch an opera career. But since her first appearances in productions of Handel and Mozart, directed by Peter Sellers, mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt has become a star of the early music circuit. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that each new role she records is an important event and that her latest recording includes some of her greatest work. After we hear Lloyd's review, we'll meet Lorraine Hunt.
Lorraine Hunt started out as a viola player. Lately, critics have been comparing the dark, rich timbre of her amazing voice to the tone of a viola. But unlike many singers who specialize in Baroque and Renaissance music, there's nothing merely instrumental about Hunt's singing. In the Peter Sellers production of Handel's Julius Caesar, which you can see on videotape, she played Sesto, the Hamlet-like son of the murdered Pompey, who is burning to avenge his father's death. Her searing ferocity was one of the many unforgettable events of that magnificent performance. Since then, she's made a number of Handel recordings, including some complete operas, under the direction of Nicholas McGeegan, a British conductor who has become an early music institution in San Francisco. McGeegan is the kind of conductor who seems more concerned with historical authenticity, the early music version of political correctness, than with creating intense dramatic experiences. Hunt has sounded pretty tame under McGeegan's direction. Last year, in the title role of Charpentier's Medea, conducted by William Christie, her straitjacket was off and she was hair-raising. She's back with McGeegan in the title role of another wonderful Handel opera, Ariodante. McGeegan remains a pedestrian conductor, but at least he's learned to give Hunt more latitude. Or she's simply taking it. This is one of her very best recorded performances, and she sings some of the greatest music Handel ever composed. I'd like to play you one excerpt, because I think it's worth the price of the whole 3-CD set. In a plot from Ariosto's Orlando Furioso, a plot that Shakespeare also borrowed, the hero thinks he sees his girlfriend spending the night with the villain. It's actually the villain's girlfriend dressed in the heroine's clothes. Scherza infida, Ariodante sings. That faithless woman enjoys herself in the embrace of her lover, while because of her, betrayed, I now go to embrace death. Hunt's fellow singers range from more than competent to, let's just say, less so. The Freiburger Baroque Orchestra sounds okay, but under McGuigan, they just keep chugging away. Aria Dante was a big hit for Handel. This complete recording also includes some very attractive music that he replaced in later performances. But besides the music itself, the only real interest in this recording is Lorraine Hunt. And that's a lot more than most opera recordings have going for them these days.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the new recording of Handel's Aria Dante on Harmonia Mundi. Lorraine Hunt, from a new recording of Handel's Aria Dante. We'll meet Lorraine Hunt after a break. This is Fresh Air. After Lord Schwartz's enthusiastic review of Lorraine Hunt, we wanted to talk with her. I was particularly interested in hearing about her transition from violist to singer. She decided to make the change at the age of 29. I asked her how she did it.
I was playing viola, one of my gigs in the Bay Area, where I'm from, San Francisco Bay Area. And Kent Nagano had recently become the director of the Berklee Symphony, and I was principal viola there. And he had this really wild idea to do the opera Hansel and Gretel and take it to prisons. And my parents had both been involved in opera, and my father a director and my mother a singer, and so I had been in productions myself. As a child, I had been at one of the Gingerbread Children in Hansel and Gretel, and so I knew the opera well, and I said, oh, I know that opera. I was a gingerbread kid. I could do the role of Hansel, the mezzo role. And he said, okay. So this was after, you know, many years of not singing or not, you know, sort of seriously studying or anything. And we did this cut-up, edited version of Hansel and Gretel, and we took it to San Quentin Prison. And we didn't have much of an audience, but they did seem to be appreciative and, you know, wanted our phone numbers afterwards. that's terrible.
Not a big turnout for opera in the prison?
No. I don't know. I guess the publicity hadn't been very thorough or something. And also, we had to put together our costumes because, you know, it was just all very low budget. So I just wore some, you know, pants that I cut off at the knee, and I couldn't figure out how to flatten my chest out. So I just wore a, you know, a flannel shirt, and I was supposed to be a boy, Hansel, and I had very long hair, and I found a wig at the Salvation Army, stuck it on my head. So after the show at San Quentin, I took the wig off, and we're walking. We had to walk through the yard, the open yard, where to leave. And as we're walking through the yard, I heard this guy say to another guy at a little bit of a distance, I heard him say, "Shit, I thought that was a dude with a big ass." And I took it as a great compliment because I thought that, you know, with that wig and my flannel shirt, I'd been completely unconvincing as a boy. But I guess it wasn't so bad. So
well, that's really funny because, you know, a lot of the opera roles that mezzo sopranos get are male roles in early operas.
Yeah,
the roles that used to be sung by castrati.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, thank God for
I guess the guys in prison didn't realize that.
Yeah. Thank God for the period costumes that, you know, where they have the big coats and everything. It helps disguise my curves. but anyway, that was sort of what got me back into singing.
What an unconventional door back into singing.
It was, and I remember on the bus back, people were talking about the Met auditions. And I said, I should do the Met auditions. So I entered the Met auditions that year. And that sort of, I really got back into singing.
When you got back into singing and wanted to find teachers again, did people say to you, well, it's just too late? You know, if you had continued with singing after college, that would have been all right. But now it's too late. Because isn't opera the kind of singing where you're expected to undergo rigorous development for many, many years and then start singing professionally without a big gap in between?
Yeah, I did get... I actually never got that at first going back. It was when... The only time I got that kind of talk was when I went back to school, you know, and here I am, I think I was 29 and turned 30 that first year that I went back to school in this opera program where everybody, you know, was almost 10 years younger than I. And that's one thing that I think is unfortunate about conservatories and colleges is that it's so young, youth-oriented, and it's not necessarily reflective of the real world out there. You know, people were, you know, we're learning to write our resumes and all those in our bios, and people were you know, my fellow students, encouraging me to lie about my age mm-hmm. on my resume. You know, and I was very proud of turning 30, and I, you know, I no way I was going to lie about it. But, you know, that kind of mentality that, oh, that somehow I was, you know, past some, you know, ideal age for getting accepted for various. And, you know, there have been those age limits for certain competitions so that people get alarmed if, you know, they're getting near passing the mark where they're not going to be able to win any more money or, you know, win these opportunities. But, you know, I try to encourage young singers not to worry so much about that. I mean, they're with a voice, if you take care of it, it's something that can last a really long time.
So when you started singing again, you knew you were a mezzo?
No, I went, I was singing soprano then when I went back to school.
Why? Because when the opera that got you back, Hansel and Gretel, you were singing mezzo in that. You were singing lower.
Well, the teachers and people that were hearing me sing, I remember at the Met auditions after that, Hansel, I auditioned as a mezzo, and a lot of the judges said, you're not a mezzo, you're a soprano. And granted, I hadn't taken lessons for years. I just sort of went into the auditions, you know, cold. And when I first went to the conservatory, they were my teacher and, you know, think, oh, you'll be a countess in Figaro. And
the roles are better for sopranos?
No, it wasn't. It was just where my voice was centered at that time. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it just kept settling a little lower and lower, and now it's
low.
I say, well, now I also have this cold, which is making it a little lower. But I like to say I've now settled into my viola voice.
Now, what's the difference between a mezzo soprano and a soprano in the range?
It's, well, obviously a soprano generally sings higher, but it's mostly about where the center of the voice lies is what determines, you know, what would determine a soprano and mezzo. I mean, there's mezzos that can sing, you know, quite high. I mean, a lot of mezzos have no trouble with the top. It's more about where the voice is centered, and it's generally lower than a soprano.
Now, when you're a mezzo-soprano, do you get a lot of male roles, the roles that had originally been written for castrati?
Yeah, I seem to be suited for them, as I say.
Suited, no pun intended.
Not necessarily body type-wise, mm-hmm. But there's some kind of, you know, my male energy is kicks right in when I'm doing these roles, and it seems to work well. I really enjoy it. I love the gender bending aspects of what I do, and getting to play men and women and girls and boys, and I love that.
My guest is mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt. When you decided to actually become a singer and you went back and started studying again, were there parts of your range that you weren't yet comfortable in and that you really had to develop? And if so, how did you develop it?
Well, the top was always a problem when I first started singing again, especially since I was trying to sing soprano. So it was never easy. I just had a lot of tension and, you know, I think it had a lot to do with my breath and all the other stuff that was in the way, technical tensions and holding. And so even though my voice is centered lower now, the top is easier.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the bottom of my voice is opened up too, which has been a great, great kind of discovery for me in the last few years, where the bottom is really filled out and it's just feels like this great foundation, which then allows the top to be freer. And when I was first singing as a soprano, I had a teacher who sort of scared me off singing, exploring my chest voice, which is the low part of the voice. So I never used it, and you know, I suppose there were some good reasons for that. But now it's a great, great new part of my voice that makes it feel complete.
Well, it's, I think, one of the things that's so distinctive about your voice is that chest voice, the deeper tones.
Mm.
Can you show us the difference between, you know, a chest voice and the higher voice?
Okay, here's a little chest voice. Deep river. Oh, that's really low. Deep river. That's chest voice. My home is over Jordan, deep river, Lord. I want to cross over into campground.
Well, that's quite lovely.
So, I didn't really go way up, but haven't warmed up today.
Do you ever have trouble crossing over in a phrase from the chest voice to the head voice? You know, if a phrase is crossing that line.
Yeah, sometimes.
Was that a barrier you had to overcome when you were training?
Not really. It never was a big problem. But every once in a while there'll be a phrase that's written in a certain way that you know, maybe goes right on the break. And the break in my voice is becoming less and less, but it tends to be around middle C, where middle C is a note for me that sometimes goes easily into chest voice and sometimes it wants to stay mixed in with the middle register. So, you know, depending on the piece and what the phrase is, sometimes it you know, wants to, it doesn't know which way to go.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the person who gave you your first really big professional break as a singer was the director Peter Sellers, who cast you in a production of Handel's Julius Caesar,
yeah.
Yes?
He and Craig Smith, who was the music director.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking before about how much you like the gender-bending aspect of singing male roles. And, boy, I mean, you really got to dress and drag for this production.
Yeah.
You were wearing, a contemporary man's haircut, which I suppose is a contemporary woman's haircut, too, for a lot of people. But you're wearing a man's suit, looking... Well, very butch, I guess, would be one way of putting it.
Yeah, I looked actually quite preppy. I was supposed to be about a 14-year-old boy, and I had a blue and white striped seersucker jacket and, what do you call those? Chinos and topsiders in a little skinny tie and a short kind of slightly punky haircut, but yeah, that was fun.
Was it a different experience for you doing a male role in contemporary drag as opposed to, you know, doing it in a period costume in the clothes of a man?
Well, yeah, I did obsess about having to wear pants on stage, which, you know, modern dress. I was very self-conscious, you know, about showing my legs. Because that, I mean, it was just a little, in a period costume, the pants are either, you know, knee pants and they're kind of baggy and you have a coat that, you know, covers your thighs and all that. But I just felt a little more exposed. But Dunya Romakova did a great job in the costuming there. So it was a little nerve-wracking. And of course, then you always have to, they have to make this special binders, we call them, to go under the shirt to flatten you out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a challenge, too.
It's be pretty uncomfortable. But,
well, that's the challenge, is getting it to really look right. And
well, here's what I can't figure out. I mean, you have to breathe really deeply when you're singing. You have to have a lot of freedom in your body so your lungs can expand. Now, if you have something binding your bosom, how can you get the breath that you need?
Well, that's the trick, is to get, you know, they have to use some kind of stretchy material and that'll just be enough holding in and still not encumber me.
Well, I have one last question for you. Do you find that singing is any more or less enjoyable now that you've been doing it professionally for a long time, as opposed to the period before you became a professional singer, when you just sang for pleasure?
I'd have to say generally it's immensely satisfying, and I get a great deal of joy from it. Just the act of singing is, for me, you know, especially when I'm feeling well and my voice is just feeling free and soaring, it's a wonderful, invigorating, you know, healing experience, even just for me personally. And then getting together with great musicians and wonderful orchestras, conductors, or great pianists. And every now and then, like from my past, when I used to sing in a choir every Sunday and do Bach cantatas, just, making music is just one of the highest things for me.
Lorraine Hunt, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt. She's featured on a new recording of Handel's Aria Dante. It's on the Harmonio Mundi record label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.